Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Pennsylvania passed two negative coronavirus milestones this week. More than 200,000 people in the state have tested positive for COVID-19 since the pandemic began last March. Pennsylvania also set a one-day record with 2,751 cases on Tuesday. The number of reported cases has been rising for the last few weeks. It appears that that dreaded second wave or fall surge is here. Is it? What's behind the increased COVID numbers? And what can be done to mitigate the spread of the virus? Joining us today is Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. Dr. Levine, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Once again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Levine, is this the second wave?
So we are clearly in the fall resurgence that we have been discussing for the last number of months, and we have been preparing for. The United States is seeing significant increases in terms of the number of new cases of COVID-19, particularly in the Midwest and the Mountain West. States where the highest increases are being seen include North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Montana, Wyoming, but also Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, and headed east. So we are not an island. Pennsylvania is not an island, and we are certainly seeing the same increases that are being seen throughout the country.
What do you think is driving the increases?
We are seeing increases in all areas of Pennsylvania. Yesterday's data, 57 of 67 counties had seen increases in terms of their seven-day average of new cases. We're also seeing increases in all age groups. So, you know, in September, it was primarily young people, particularly in college, but we're seeing increases in children and young adults, but also middle-aged adults and seniors as well. It is a combination of increases in schools and colleges, as well as in long-term care facilities, but also really significant community spread in all regions of Pennsylvania.
And we're going to touch on a few of the things you just mentioned, but, you know, some theories that are out there is that right now, 9 months into this, that much of the country, including Pennsylvania, has fatigue, mitigation fatigue. And we still have a segment of the population that will not wear masks or practice social distancing. Are those factors in this spread?
Well, certainly, members of the population that are not doing those mitigation factors, such as wearing masks, washing their hands, practicing social distancing, is contributing to community spread. And so this highlights that in regards to COVID-19, we are all interconnected. That is what the pandemic has taught us. And so we really need to stand united. We need to all do those simple mitigation measures of washing our hands, wearing masks, practicing social distancing, avoiding gatherings, large and small gatherings. And if we do that, we will be able to stop the spread. And so the word of the day is answer the call. We need to all answer the call for our collective responsibility to stop the spread of COVID-19.
But Dr. Levine, you've been saying that since the beginning, and it's not just you. I mean, there are many people. I think that, you know, most Pennsylvanians, probably all Pennsylvanians, have heard those warnings, but we still have a large segment of the population that either refuses to follow those guidelines, or, as I said, that fatigue they have that, oh, things are never going to get back to normal. I want them to be normal. I mean, what you're saying makes a lot of sense to a lot of people, but how do you get those people that are not following the guidelines to do it?
Well, you know, that is the challenge for public health, is that we need to be able to articulate our message and get that message across so that we can reinforce it and to work to change the behaviors of people who have been reluctant. It is certainly understandable that people are challenged every day by this global pandemic. But the fact is that here it is, and we all have to face that fact. And we all need to work together. So I keep repeating those messages in different ways to try to encourage people that if they're not working towards changing their behavior, that we can get them to do that now.
Dr. Levine, yesterday I spoke with a couple researchers from Carnegie Mellon University. Are you familiar with the research that they're doing across the country?
I'm familiar with some of their research. I'm not familiar with who you spoke to yesterday.
Okay. Well, one of the things they said that one of the pieces of data that they found that surprised the researchers somewhat, and it tends to make sense, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on it, is that they found that people who know someone who has contracted COVID tend to take it more seriously than those who know of no one who takes it more seriously. I mean, that makes sense, but it's a shame that we have to go that far. But I guess the point is that it has to have an impact on someone in particular for them to take it seriously. Not everyone, but for some people.
So that would not be a surprising result for me. I think that that would be true of many illnesses. That if you know of someone, a family member that has had heart disease, then you're going to take precautions against heart disease more carefully. Or if you know someone that has contracted lung cancer or emphysema, then you'll be less likely to smoke because you can see those implications. So I think that's true of really all illnesses, and I think that's natural in terms of human behavior. But we all do need to face the fact that we are in this together. What each individual person does impacts not only themselves, but also their family and their community. And that's why we all need to work together to stop the spread of COVID-19. And as we do that, we will be successful.
Is this surge any different than the one in the spring when it first started?
Yes. In the spring, the increase was even more rapid than it has been this fall. We really saw that exponential growth of COVID-19. And the geography was somewhat different. It was primarily in the Northeast, in the Mid-Atlantic area, where we saw the biggest increases. The summer, it was really more in the South and the West. Now it's the Midwest. But in addition, it was much more in seniors that were being impacted and getting infected with COVID-19. The rise that we're seeing now is actually even more broad in terms of geography and in terms of all age groups being impacted.
Earlier this week, Dr. Levine, you talked about families limiting their holiday plans. What should they be thinking about?
Well, so I know that this is a really a challenging recommendation, given that Halloween is around the corner, but then even more so that Thanksgiving is coming, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, where families have traditionally gotten together in small groups or large groups, seeing relatives that might live in other parts of the state or the country. And people, of course, look forward to that family and that community interaction and get-togethers. However, in the midst of this global pandemic, we are seeing that not only large gatherings, but actually relatively small gatherings are spreading this virus. And so this year, we were asking people to change their behavior in terms of the holidays and really stay within their household and to contact others remotely, on the different computer platforms and phone platforms that we can use, to try to make the holidays as festive as possible, but to protect ourselves and our families and our communities from the spread of COVID-19. That is a sacrifice, and that is really challenging to ask people to do. But the fact is, it's going to be so important to stopping the spread of COVID-19 as we get into the winter months.
you know, and this maybe is just a personal observation, but I sense that this may be even a more difficult challenge than some of the sacrifices that were asked earlier in the pandemic. And it kind of goes back to that mitigation fatigue that, you know, there probably are a lot of people out there said, okay, I haven't been working. I haven't been going out as much. I haven't been going to the gym. But now you're asking me to sacrifice my holidays, that I can't be with my family members. I mean, this would seem to be a difficult ask.
You know, I agree with you. This is a difficult request, and I understand the challenges, and I understand the sacrifice. But the fact is that this virus is here. It is extremely contagious. It can have devastating impact on people and families and communities. And we have seen over and over again where relatively small gatherings, you know, maybe, 10 people, 20 people, can lead to significant spread and become almost super spreader events as it goes through a family and a community. And so this is what we're asking people to do, really to protect themselves and their loved ones and their neighbors.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania Secretary of Health. We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Levine will be with us for about another 10 minutes if you have a question or a comment. Let me get to some of the listener questions for you, Dr. Levine. Douglas wants to know, is there a growing disconnect between cases, hospitalizations, and deaths? And if so, does this mean that an increase in cases may not necessarily result in such significant lockdowns as we saw earlier in the year?
Well, that's a complex question with several different parts. So there is a connection between the increasing number of cases, hospitalizations, and tragically, deaths. Procession often takes weeks, if not a month or more, where we see an increase of cases and then several weeks later an increase in hospitalizations and then an increase in deaths. That is being seen throughout the country. Probably some of the best examples are in Wisconsin and North and South Dakota, but we are seeing that in Pennsylvania. We have had a significant increase in our hospitalization rate, and we are starting to see a small increase in terms of the number of deaths per day. So it is also true, however, that medical care has improved dramatically. And so we are seeing much less people who are severely infected in the ICU or on a ventilator or who are dying from COVID-19 than we saw in the spring. And some of that is because of age differences, but a lot of it is because the medical care is better, the intensive care is better, the use of medications such as remdesivir and dexamethasone and others is better. And so we are very happy that that the medical care has improved and we're seeing less deaths. But if you look throughout aspects of the nation, if you look at Europe, this virus still has a great danger to people, which can lead to death, but can also lead to significant long-term complications, the quote-unquote long haulers who have chronic side effects after their case of COVID-19. In terms of mitigation, you know, there are three ways to deal with a pandemic. You can work to contain it, and we're doing that through our testing and contact tracing. You can mitigate it, and we do have mitigation orders in effect. First of all, that's what mask wearing and hand washing, et cetera, is. Those are mitigation efforts. In addition, we do have moderate targeted limitations on indoor restaurants, which can spread the virus, as well as large gatherings indoor and outdoor. And then we can have the distribution of a vaccine, and we'll be, you know, we have a lot of contacts with the federal government and other states and are waiting for vaccine or vaccines to be deemed safe and effective, and then we have significant plans for that distribution and administration. Those are the three ways that we deal with the pandemic.
Here's a big question, though. With cases increasing, are there any plans? Has it been discussed of returning to possibly the yellow or even the red phases in some areas of the state?
There are no plans to do that type of broad mitigation at this time.
Why not? I mean, if cases are increasing, why not?
I think that there are a lot of reasons. I think that one is, you mentioned, the pandemic fatigue. I think the other is because of the significant impact on the economy. But we have significant ways that we're reducing the spread of COVID-19 in nursing homes. Universal testing in nursing homes, as well as the regional collaborative program, working with academic medical centers throughout the state to support nursing homes, and because the medical care is better. And so as you weigh all of those factors, there are no plans to do that type of broad statewide mitigation, the red, yellow, green, at this time.
Questions from listeners. A majority of the COVID-19 tests administered in Pennsylvania these days are antigen tests, and we don't have as much data on those as PCR tests. You issued an order earlier this month to reinforce that all antigen test results are required to be reported to the Department of Health. Have laboratories been responding?
Yes. So I just want to clarify, the majority of tests that we're seeing are not antigen tests. So yesterday we had over 33,000 PCR tests, which is genetic material tests, and we reported 3,500 antigen tests. So the majority are still the PCR, but are distributing the antigen test cards that have been provided by the federal government. There are other antigen test kits, and they are increasing. And we're very pleased that we are getting those results, which is critical for us to have up-to-date data.
Are we testing enough?
We are testing so many more people than we did previously. And the rollout of testing in the spring was one of the biggest challenges that we faced, because our containment strategies are based upon significant testing. And the rollout through the federal government and the companies was just really slow. We are up to an average of approximately 35,000 test results per day. Again, a combination of the PCR test and the antigen test. And we want to do even more, but we are well within the guidelines recommended by the federal government in terms of where a state should be. But more than the actual numbers, we want to make sure that testing is accessible. We want to make sure it's available, but also adaptable. For example, the introduction of the antigen tests and these rapid antigen test cards from Abbott, the Abbott BinaxNOW Now cards. And so we have actually a quite robust plan, collaborating with the governor's office and Director Michael Huff, to distribute those cards, and we're getting those results back.
Virginia has a question that I'm sure many of us have experienced. She says, what would you suggest be done when a stranger in a public place is not wearing a mask, comes closer than 6 feet from you? Yesterday in the grocery store, I was in the checkout line when a person came behind me wearing no mask, as well as within 3 feet of me. What should I do?
Well, I would move. I would move away. So I know that might be difficult if you're in a line at a grocery store. But if I was in that situation, I would take my groceries and I would put them in the cart and move them to a different line. We want stores to enforce mask wearing, but we don't want physical confrontation with people. And that's why we all need to work together. So I would avoid conflict, but I would move away so that you're not exposed.
Election coming up on Tuesday. We have a listener says, I'm scheduled as an official poll watcher on election day. Although I want to do my patriotic duty next Tuesday and answer the call, I'm concerned about unmasked COVID positive people coming to the polls. Other than refusing to work next week, what are the best efforts I should employ to best protect myself and others when volunteering on election day?
Sure. Well, first, again, I would wear a mask. I would wash your hands frequently. I would use hand sanitizer. I would stay socially distant, 6 feet apart. In collaboration with Secretary Buchvar and the Pennsylvania Department of State, we are all working together to make this a safe election day. And to protect the public health with, of course, the significant election. So we have very robust plans to protect the public and the poll workers and the poll watchers, but everybody does have an individual responsibility. And so I would wear a mask, wash your hands, use hand sanitizer, and keep 6 feet away.
But if someone, a voter, comes in without a mask, I mean, are they allowed to do that?
So I actually don't know at my fingertips exactly what the polls will do if someone comes in without a mask. I'm going to be asking our press secretary, Nate Wardle, and he can get back to you probably while you're still on the show to give you that answer. I don't have that at my fingertips about what we want the polls to do.
Okay. Dr. Levine, I know we only have a couple of minutes. I know your schedule is tight, and I thank you for being with us today.
Sure, of course.
Contact tracing. Saw earlier this week you mentioned that 71% of the people that have been contacted are not answering all the questions. What aren't they answering and why?
Well, so, as people are contacted to do the case investigations and contact tracing, they're not answering some of the questions that we really need. So, for example, answering questions about whether they've been in large gatherings or whether they've been in businesses like a restaurant or a bar or something like that. I think that people are just nervous and concerned, and I can understand that. But we need that information to protect the public health. We need people to answer their phone when the Pennsylvania Department of Health calls, and we need people to be forthright. We're not looking to blame anybody. We're not looking to, we're not in the enforcement arm, of anything. We just want to know the information so that we can take the public health measures to stop the spread and protect the public health in Pennsylvania. So that's why the word of the day is answer the call, answer the phone call, answer the call to download the app. We have more than 380,000 people on the app, but we're looking for over 1 million, the COVID Alert PA app. And we want people to answer the call to show their collective responsibility for the common good, wear masks, wash their hands, practice social distancing, avoid gatherings, so we can all work together to stop the spread.
I just checked the app, my app, on my phone as we were speaking, so, and I'm good today.
Thank you for downloading it.
One final question. Is there an end in sight? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Sure. I am a positive and optimistic person, and we will get through this in Pennsylvania. But we have to get through it together, united. Again, through our containment efforts, through our mitigation efforts, our targeted mitigation efforts, as the vaccine rolls out, which will be an important tool. It's not a miracle cure. It's a critically important tool. Pennsylvania and the United States will get through this together.
Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania Secretary of Health. Dr. Levine, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye now. Stay safe.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Since we first heard of the COVID-19 coronavirus 8 months ago, doctors have said those who contract the virus and have a pre-existing medical condition or illness get sicker and are more likely to die from it. A large international study that included researchers at the Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey have found just how much those comorbidities can contribute to a serious COVID illness or death. Joining us, Dr. Patty Santongo, epidemiology doctoral student at the College of Medicine and research assistant professor at Penn State's Department of Engineering, Science, and Mathematics. Dr. Santongo, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also, it's not often we get a husband and wife, but Anna Santongo, doctor of public health candidate and research scientist in the Department of Trauma at Penn State College of Medicine. Dr. Santongo, well, thank you for being with us. So we have both Santongos with us. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
We knew that those pre-existing medical conditions or illnesses were more susceptible, those who had pre-existing conditions or illnesses were more susceptible to getting sicker or even dying. But what does this research show us?
Hi, thank you, Scott, for the introduction, and thank you. So we conducted the first-of-a-kind systematic review and meta-analysis looking at the most deadly pre-existing conditions to have with COVID-19. We analyzed 25 studies with a total of 65,484 patients across 24 countries, including countries from Europe, Asia, Middle East, North and South America, and Africa. And what we found was that compared with individuals who did not have comorbidities, the risk of death was significantly greater in those with hypertension, diabetes, congestive heart failure, chronic kidney disease, and cancer. And in addition, cerebrovascular disease demonstrated a higher risk of death, although it wasn't significantly a significant finding. But chronic liver disease, COPD, asthma, and HIV, they were not significantly associated with mortality.
You know, one of the things that strikes me about that is that, you know, when we first heard of COVID-19, it was thought to be a respiratory illness. And maybe it still is, because it does obviously have an impact on your lungs. But many of the conditions that you mention, other than COPD, you know, have very little to do with the lungs or as a respiratory condition. So why is it that, you know, hypertension or heart disease or diabetes, why is it that people with those conditions are more susceptible to getting really sick and maybe even dying?
That's a very nice question, Scott. There's a lot of information we are learning about this disease, COVID-19. But what we know so far is that most of those conditions you've mentioned, they are conditions which, at the background, they are driven by inflammation process. And there's a certain condition known as a cytokine storm, where in patients actually who die with COVID-19, who die, there's this excessive release of pro-inflammatory cytokines. And so the hypothesis is that all these conditions we just mentioned are from hypertension and cardiovascular disease. They're also lying on the background of obesity, and which is still also a driver of inflammation. And despite the fact these are not specifically coordinated to the lungs, but the wear and the tear, also known as the allostatic load, induced on the body from these chronic pre-existing conditions, could basically leave the body defenseless. And when the virus comes, when these patients get the virus, they're more susceptible to higher risk of mortality or even to higher risk of complications.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, our guest during this segment of the program, Dr. Patty Santiago, his wife, Anna Santiago, both with Penn State College of Medicine, part of an international study. And that's one of the things that's unique about this, about the chances or the impacts of a comorbidity of a pre-existing condition on your prognosis for COVID-19. And what they found is that depending on what the pre-existing condition is, that it increases your chances of getting really sick or maybe even dying. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Now, there are a few things that are very unique about the research that you did. And one is that you actually put, I don't even know how to refer to it, chances or the amount of increase that a person has of dying depending on what their pre-existing condition is. The one that stuck out to me, and it looked like, maybe I'm wrong here, but I just want to make sure that I have it right. Chronic kidney disease seems to be the one that increases the chances of dying the most. Is that accurate?
Yes, Scott. What we did actually is we created relative risk of the risk of dying from each of these comorbidities. And we found that those with chronic kidney disease were at 3 times increased risk of mortality from COVID-19 compared to those who did not have chronic kidney disease. But overall, heart disease was another driver of mortality, diabetes, and congestive heart failure.
Hmm. And, okay, now you looked at, you know, the increased risk with these pre-existing conditions. I want to take a step even further than that, and I don't know whether the research covered this or not, but one of the things we're finding with COVID-19 is that even after someone recovers, that they may have some conditions that they didn't have before. For example, heart disease, something called brain fog. Is that something that the research looked at?
We didn't, in our current research, we did not look at that. However, there are ongoing researches where we are trying to look at the complications of COVID-19, which is very important because people are going to survive, as like Dr. Levin said, the medical care is improving, so the survival chances are increasing. But the question is, what are the complications we are going to look at, or which are going to come out of COVID-19, such as those you've just explained? But we haven't looked at those yet.
So that brings up a question. How do you want this data to be used? How do you want this information to be used? I mean, it makes sense right up front that people who are suffering from a pre-existing condition, that they have to be even more careful. But how do you want people to use this information?
That's a million-dollar question, Scott. And moving beyond identifying the risk factors of COVID-19 mortality, that's great. But the question is, so what? And answering that so what question is basically twofold. Number one, treatment. Can we improve the treatment outcome, what we call maximizing the treatment outcome of those with COVID-19, and how can we maximize that? We have a medical term known as the risk stratification. So by identifying which patients are more likely to die, it kind of puts physician at in a better position to provide specific treatments to those patients. But also, speaking of an international study, there are countries, which is outside the U.S., who may not have these treatments available for everyone. Now, that means they need to concentrate on these patients we identified as having higher risk, and they should receive the treatment. Number two is prevention. Now, of course, the best intervention for this COVID-19 prevention will be a vaccine, which is perhaps coming. But the question is, even if a vaccine comes, you know, is everyone going to have access to this vaccine? And if the answer is no, then again, our research, which I'm glad has already been taken up by the CDC, can guide the government and non-government organization entities to help basically to identify those patients or people who might actually benefit most from the vaccination.
Dr. Sandaga, you just brought up a point about how unique this research is, in that it was not just the United States. It was an international study, and it was a large study, 65,000 patients. In the research, did you find any differences, any trends between the U.S. and what's happening other places around the world?
That's a very good question. So we did not look at that specifically, but to our surprise was the HIV/AIDS. Now, putting all these numbers in perspective, all the comorbidities we are talking about, even though some of these comorbidities are highly prevalent in the United States, others are not. Now, take an example of diabetes, like 31 million people in the United States, cardiovascular disease, 18 million. And hypertension, specifically, like one in two adults in the U.S. have hypertension. But when it comes to things like HIV/AIDS, where over 38 million people currently have HIV/AIDS, the greatest burden lies on low and middle-income countries. So perhaps we expected to see a higher HIV/AIDS to be a higher risk in these countries, but it wasn't. And we don't have the answers for now, but perhaps, of course, our results should be interpreted with caution. It could be because of the small numbers of studies we got from low and middle-income countries such as Africa. But future studies should carefully look at all these different comorbidities, which may not be highly prevalent in the U.S., but highly prevalent in other low and middle income countries, because in those countries, even though currently we don't have high mortality rate, but we don't know. The disease is still changing. We don't know a lot about it. But as we get better in understanding this disease, I believe more research should be conducted in this area.
We have a question from a listener, Mike, who asks, if you have controlled coronary artery disease, controlled with medication, are you saying that that still dramatically increases the risk of dying or severe complications from COVID?
Scott, you just almost tempting me to talk about our next study, but we don't have time. So the answer to that question is actually controlling this cardiovascular disease with what we call SCA inhibitors or the ARB angiotensin receptor blockers. It is protective from actually dying, and there's been a lot of controversy about the SCA2 receptors and the risk of COVID-19. But our research, the new one which is coming out in BMJ, is basically answering that question and saying, no, you're protected.
Okay. And we had a similar question about that, but this listener wanted to know, we only have about 2 minutes, what degree is age a factor in the likelihood of death from COVID-19?
Great question as well. Now, all the comorbidities we've talked about, the pre-existing comorbidities, these are comorbidities which are highly prevalent in the older population. Now, that doesn't mean that the younger population should take a step back and stop the social behavior interventions such as mask wearing and social distancing. But yes, age, as you get older, you are more likely to have these comorbidities. So age is a big factor.
You know something, Dr. Santaga, you said a few minutes ago about HIV/AIDS that you were surprised. That's one of the things about this illness that it seems like the things we think we know about it, there are very often occasions where we find out that, no, we didn't know that, or it surprises us. I only have about a minute left. Would you agree with that?
That's right, Scott. You know, this is a new disease, and we are, even as physicians and scientists, we are learning as we go along. But the good news is we are getting better at it. This information we are getting is going to help improve, first and foremost, survival in those who have the COVID-19, but also those who don't have to do a better prevention.
Dr. Patty Santaga and Anna Santaga, both with the Penn State College of Medicine in Hershey. I want to thank both of you for the research, really opened some eyes, but thank you for being on the program today.
Thanks,
yes,
Doc.
You're
Thanks
welcome. Thank
us.
You so much for having us.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The latest Franklin and Marshall College poll came out this week. It is the last one before the November 3rd election, or as many people refer to it, the day that voting ends. Joining us now is political analyst and pollster from FNM, Dr. G. Terry Madonna. Dr. Madonna, welcome to the program.
Hey, my pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So it is the last poll before November 3rd. What are the significant findings in the poll this time?
Well, I think there's several of them. First of all, let's start with the fact that we have 70% of the voters who say they are very interested in the 2020 elections. That's not dissimilar from what we had back in September of 2016. But I do think, you know, it's possible that the turnout, I would expect that overall the turnout will be higher than we've had in recent elections. And by the way, more of the voters in the state expect to cast their ballot in person than by mail. And that sort of surprised me because, well, what's going on right now is that there's a huge number of applicants that were in that have been placed in, you know, to get the mail-in ballot and absentees. I actually thought there might be more people who actually vote by mail than in person. But we're going to have to wait and see. Obviously, it's fairly changeable. And then the other important question, Scott, is we asked people if they believed the state will be accurate if, you know, because email in mail-in voting is widely used. The fact of the matter is that 62% of Pennsylvania voters think that the mail-in voting will be accurately accounted and reported. Now, there's strong differences between Democrats and Republicans, with Democrats more likely to say that the, you know, the mail-in voting will be accurately reported, and Republicans much less so. So there are a couple of sort of the key findings. There's some other aspects that we can certainly talk about.
Well, I'm going to ask you to put on your political analyst hat here for a moment. Two things that you mentioned. You said you expect a high turnout. And the
Correct.
Other is that the majority of Pennsylvanians say that they will vote in person rather than by mail. The general consensus has been, and tell me whether you agree with this, is that bigger turnout, higher turnout, tends to favor Joe Biden, because Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, the populated cities, if there are more voters. But the second thing is, if more people vote in person, that the people voting in person are more likely to be Trump supporters than Biden supporters.
Correct.
Or I should say that most of the Trump supporters will vote in person rather than by mail. Do you subscribe to those two theories?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And as I think all your listeners know, that the election officials in the counties have 3 extra days to count the mail-in and absentees. That means Friday of election week. So it might appear on election night that Donald Trump carried some areas, which when the mail-in voting is counted up, might switch to Biden. Obviously, we're going to have to wait and see for sure, but that's certainly an expectation that a lot of political analysts have. And you're right, more Democrats will vote by mail than Republicans, and more Republicans are likely to vote in person. But again, look at the thousands and thousands of Pennsylvanians have already showed up in person, where, you know, you can vote in satellite centers and go into election headquarters where they've already allowed for election, you know, for in-person voting before November 3.
In this poll, Terry, and I'm sure there are many people interested in the horse race aspect of it, the poll
yep.
shows that Joe Biden leads President Trump in Pennsylvania, the snapshot right now, 50-44%, a 6% difference. Now, this is different than 2016, in that your last poll in 2016 was done like 2 weeks before Election Day. This is closer to Election Day. You know, a lot of people are questioning, you know, they go back to 2016 and talk about the polls. What about this time? What's different this time with this poll this close to Election Day?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, remember that Trump was an outsider, and make no mistake about it, he ran against the establishment. And there probably were some voters who simply wouldn't tell pollsters, you know, that they were going to vote for Trump. But now what's the big difference is he's an incumbent. He has a record. And for the most part, his voters have not been reluctant to show up in rallies and to, you know, talk about their support for him. That's been much more common than I think we had 4 years ago. So I would be actually surprised if the polls are way off, you know, significantly off, you know, after when the votes get tabulated. But obviously, we're going to have to wait and see. But
another
I think that the poll.
No, go ahead, finish, Terry.
Well, I do think that the polls are going to be much closer, given. And the other aspect of it is that a lot of pollsters, you know, have gone back and reviewed their polling techniques, the sampling. We can go through a whole list of things, but I don't think there's any doubt that pollsters, you reviewed their sampling techniques, they reviewed their methodology, and that's another aspect that's I think very, very, very important.
Also, the poll said that there were 3% undecided. That is a huge difference from 2016. As a pollster, you've been doing this for a long time. Is 3% this close to an election Is that low? Where does that fit historically? And is that a big difference between now and 2016?
Yeah, I don't – look, what we know right now is we have a smaller number of undecided voters than we've had in recent decades, and that's because of the polarization. I mean, you know, Democrats overwhelmingly for Biden, Republicans overwhelmingly for Trump, and the polarization is so steep, and this campaign has been – the campaign has been brutal. It's been vigorous. It's been how do I put this? It's been confusing in some respects, but the bottom line is you have to ask the question, you're undecided after everything that's going on in the campaign. A lot of undecided voters don't pay as close attention to the election as decided voters and strong partisans. They don't pay as close attention, and some of these undecided voters may not even vote, but you're absolutely right. It's a smaller number than we've seen in the past.
A couple questions on the poll that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection, the first time you've asked questions like this, but I find them unique. I haven't heard, this question being asked of a lot of voters, and that is, what would a Trump victory mean to you personally, and what would a Biden victory mean to you personally? The top two answers for a Trump victory, 36% said that it would mean a division, that the country would be divided. A Biden victory, the top answer is that their concern would be about taxes. Tell me about those two questions. And is that the first time you've asked questions like that?
Yeah, I don't recall. You know, we've only been doing this since 1991. I don't recall. But here's what's going on. In the polls that we've done and others have done, when we've asked voters a fundamental question, are you voting more for Trump or against Biden? His voters say more for Trump. When we ask Biden voters, are you voting for Joe Biden or are you voting more against Donald J. Trump? And the against Donald J. Trump wins out, which shows you the incredible hostility that exists in this election. The huge differences between Biden and Trump, the acrimony that's taken place, the bitterness in the campaign. So I think that's why you get more Democrats saying we're voting against Trump. The animosity towards him among core Democratic voters is really very, very high.
But that concern with Biden, the concern about taxes, it sounds as if the Trump campaign message, TV commercials we've seen have gotten through to some voters that are making voters somewhat leery of Biden, that he will raise taxes, even though he said he would raise taxes only on those making $400,000 a year.
No, but remember, the way to think about this, or at least the way I think about it, is the Trump campaign over and over and over again has said that Trump literally, if Biden wins, he's going to raise your taxes. Their argument is he's going to get rid of the Trump tax program, which did lower taxes for people and not just the rich. And Biden insists that only on $400,000 or more income will there be increased taxation. But essentially, it's because of the nature of the campaign and what the candidates are saying over and over and over again.
Yeah. Terry, we'll have you on Smart Talk on Wednesday, the day after the election. Don't know if we'll have a whole lot of results to talk about, but there will be a lot to discuss.
Okay.
That's coming up on Wednesday. Dr. G. Terry Madonna from Franklin Marshall College, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein & Lear.